Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway, and it's great to have you with us. Before we start today's show, I want to let you know that this segment will be focusing on sexual assault. In the past few years, we've witnessed how powerful institutions, including the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, and others, have hidden decades of sexual abuse towards boys and young men. And while many of those institutions have faced consequences ranging from changes in leadership to lawsuits, those consequences can't erase the shame and suffering many of the victims faced. It's something we don't talk a lot about in this country. And yet sexual assault of boys and young men is much more pervasive than we might expect. According to the Washington Post, as many as 1 in 6 boys say they experienced sexual abuse during their childhoods. Today on The Takeaway, we explore the crisis of sexual abuse towards boys and young men and what we can do to stop it. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter at the Washington Post and the author of the forthcoming book, To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. Emma, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Richard Gartner is a psychologist and psychoanalyst and the co-founder of Male Survivor, a national organization preventing and healing the sexual victimization of boys and men. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Tommy Curry is a professor of philosophy at the University of Edinburgh. Tommy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Emma, how common is the sexual assault of boys and young men?
Well, as I learned in my reporting, it is as many as 1 in 6 boys who are sexually assaulted or abused before they reach age 18. But the number, the number is hard to tell because sexual assault reporting for anybody, many people who are victims don't report, and the number of boys who report being sexually assaulted sort of varies depending on the survey. But one leading researcher I spoke to said, you know, whatever the number is, it's a lot higher than we think it is, and we need to take action. So he felt like it was less important to know the specific percentage than for people to understand that this is an often hidden problem.
Tommy, you've researched the prevalence of sexual assault among Black boys and men specifically. What do we know about that?
Oh, well, we know the data shows us that we've had evidence that Black boys have been sexually victimized at very early ages, sometimes as young as 7 and 9, since the 1950s. A lot of the early racist discourse was built on the idea that poor Black boys were sexually promiscuous. So lots of white sociologists used to document that Black boys became sexually active at a very, very young age with older women. The studies that we've done, we're looking at actual survivors, men who were victims of child sexual victimization, and trying to gather some of their stories. And even in 2018, when we completed our study, we saw some overlap with that age range, that lots of Black boys in the United States are having their first sexual experience, usually with much older women as early as the age of 9. And of course, that's continuing until their average age of sexual debut, which is usually before their 14th or 15th birthday.
And Richard, Tommy was just talking about particularly the incidences of sexual abuse against young Black boys who are often hypersexualized themselves and often, interestingly, sexually abused by older women. Does that pattern play out for the other boys and young men that you have worked with?
Absolutely. Sexual abuse of boys happens in every socioeconomic class, so I want to be clear about that. And the boys at greatest risk are those living with neither or only one parent, those whose parents are separated, divorced, and are remarried, and those whose parents abuse alcohol or are involved in criminal behavior, and those who are non-white, as Tommy said, of lower socioeconomic status and under 13 years of age.
And Richard, is that one of the reasons why this doesn't get as much attention as it we would assume it does, especially if we were talking about sexual assault against young women and girls.
I think the real reason is has to do with masculine gender socialization. All boys, no matter what the socioeconomic group they are from, learn how to be masculine. And unfortunately, one of the things that they consider to be unmasculine is being a victim. And so they are very, very unlikely to disclose what happened.
Emma, do we have a sense for where this happens? We know it happens across class lines, but are there areas or locations that where we see this happening more?
You know, I think we see it happening in all different kinds of places, happening in rural places, urban, suburban, happening in schools, private schools that are hard to get into, and happening, you know, in public schools that anybody can go to. So I think, as Richard said, it spans socioeconomic class. It also spans geography. I mean, there's one really, I think, important study that sort of underlines what Dr. Curry was saying about the victimization of Black boys. It was a study of the number of boys who had sexual experiences before they were 13. And in that study, Black boys were much more likely to have been to have had an early sexual experience. And of course, you can't consent when you're under 13. And in that study, the incidence of this kind of early sexual experience varied widely across cities. So it was like 5% of boys in San Francisco compared to 25% in Memphis. So I think my takeaway from that is it can happen anywhere, but it may be perhaps more concentrated in some places than others.
Tommy, when you hear that, does that connect with the research that you've seen?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, there's several studies that have been published in the last decade, Bellio and other authors, that really do show that Black boys have the earliest sexual debut of any race sex group in the United States. Again, I want to be very clear. The first cohort of Black boys that usually report the highest sexual debut is between the ages of 12 and 14. The second is between 9 and 12. So that means between 9 and 14, you have many Black boys, at least in the survey data, suggesting that they're having their first sexual experience well before they're able to consent. So what often happens is that we're numb to the fact that we have many young Black men in this society who are telling you that their first sexual debut was actually an act of statutory rape. And again, this data has been around for decades. It was even the basis of lots of racist suppositions about Black male hypersexuality and hypersexualization. The problem is that we have not defined or allowed Black men to be victims, that even though we know this, and we know that it's a public health crisis in many ways, we refuse to acknowledge the data or even their narratives because we see Black men as predators. And it's that racist construction or caricature of Black males that do not allow us as a society to take their victimization and their rape seriously.
Richard, how much of this is also, you know, we know that young girls are often taught to be fearful, to be protective of their quote-unquote private parts, to, you know, say if they're, understand the differences between bad touch and good touch. Do we do the same for boys? Are boys aware, at least, of what good touch versus bad touch is? And do we have similar conversations with boys so that they can detect when something is off?
I think it's pretty rare that boys have that conversation with their parents. The parents don't even think about it, more or less. What they do teach them is that boys are resilient and competitive, that they're mentally and physically tough, independent, all of the things that make boys not want to define themselves as sexual victims. The average age of in studies I know, as opposed to the ones that Tommy was just saying, that the average age, median age for first abusive contact is age 9, and it can go down to infants.
And that we mentioned the numbness to that as a society we have. Emma, do you, in your research and reporting this, Dave, have you found that as well, that we are sort of numb as a society to the pain at, that sexual abuse toward young boys and men could have?
Absolutely. And it was one of the most sort of shocking and profoundly affecting parts of my research for my book, was realizing the ways in which boys' pain is dismissed or not acknowledged. And I'll just give one example of a boy who was a middle school boy who was sexually assaulted during his music class at his school in Oklahoma. And the principal and the superintendent later admitted in the course of an investigation that had the same thing happen to a girl, they would have considered it sexual assault, but they just didn't see it as sexual assault. They saw it as horseplay because it was a boy, you know, this young boy was a boy. I think that was such a statement to me about the different ways that we see assault against boys versus assault against girls.
And I would imagine, Emma, that that makes it more difficult for the boys themselves to identify something happening to them.
Absolutely. And that's why I think what Richard said about, and what you said about sort of the necessity to tell our boys, tell our sons and boys we care for that their bodies are their own is so important.
Is that not happening enough right now, Emma?
I think it's not. I mean, I think that parents I talk to about this are surprised often to when they start thinking about, of course, we should tell our boys this, right? But it's not something that is quite in the air in the same way the conversation about talking to girls about the sanctity of their body is in the air.
And Richard, how do we get this into the broader conversation? I mean, obviously, we're talking about it on this show, but how do we get this to be at a place where we are now with women and sexual assault, for example?
Well, I think, you know, the men are at least 20 or 30 years behind women in terms of a public acknowledgement of this tragedy. I think what happens is every time there is something in the media, whether it is a show like this, or a trial like Jerry Sandusky at Penn State, or if a celebrity of some sort comes forward, and there have been many in recent years, and musicians like Santana, athletes like R.A. Dickey or Greg Lukianus, or performers and actors like Gabriel Byrne or Antoine Fisher, every time one of them comes forward, then there is a man out there or a boy out there who thinks, oh, someone who's a model in some way for me had this happen to him and is brave enough to come forward and to define it as abuse. Maybe I can too. And that's a big first step to getting help.
Tommy, this type of abuse can have long-lasting effects. Tell us about that.
Our studies have shown lots of different effects, pathways to mental illness, low self-esteem, higher risk of promiscuous sexual activities, a child before the age of 21. The narratives that we found from victims align pretty closely with the previous data that we've had for other sexual victims throughout the decades. I think when you're looking at Black men, especially poor Black men, there's also this psychological impact of invisibility, of disposability, that the world doesn't care about you. Lots of our subjects that we studied didn't even think about what happened to them as sexual violence or rape. In order to get them to make that connection, we had to put in a question that said, if this happened to a girl, a young girl, would you see this as rape? And practically all of them said absolutely. So there's a disconnect where they don't see the world being able to explain, much less care about them being sexual victims to older women, or in some cases, men. So they carry this trauma around with them that manifests itself in depression, low self-esteem, hopelessness, with really no way to address or remedy it.
Richard, you help men through these types of traumas. You help them deal and come to terms with it and maybe find some semblance of peace. When you hear what Tommy is saying, tell us about how that plays out in the work that you do with the men that you're working with.
Well, these effects on boys, if they're not addressed in childhood or adolescence or even young adulthood, they go underground and they affect him so that they very likely to have a wide range of symptoms, often not knowing that they were sexually abused. They have not defined it that way. But alcoholism, drug abuse, addiction to pornography or sexual contact, overeating, shopping, even gambling, all of those are likely aftermath. And it's only when men have really hit close to rock bottom that they are likely to seek some kind of treatment. And the fact is that even though that many men say that the victimization did not matter to them, they come to therapy in larger numbers than men who did not have that history.
And do they say the victimization didn't matter because they were socialized to believe that it didn't matter? I think men, in the way that we create masculinity in this country, are sometimes encouraged to be sexually active long before they may want to be.
Well, that's right. And there's very little room for a boy who is anxious about what's happening to tell somebody, because especially if it's a woman that is assaulting him, if he tells his friend is likely to say, "You're lucky." Many adults would say, "You're lucky." And then he has nowhere to go with his anxiety, and then he just feels bad about himself.
Emma, how do you begin to approach a conversation about consent with boys, with young boys?
Well, I think, with very young children, you talk about your body being your own and other people's bodies being their own. And as children get older, you can be more explicit about what that means. But the professors, two professors from Columbia, one of whom has since left Columbia, Jennifer Hirsch and Seamus Khan, wrote a book called Sexual Citizens, in which they put forth this concept of sexual citizenship, which I really like and sort of use now when I think about how to talk to my son. And it's the concept not sort of no means no or yes means yes, but that we all have dignity, and we all deserve respect, and sort of a positive way to think about that issue of consent, both in terms of how boys can think about how they want to protect their own bodies, but also how they can think about interacting with someone else's body when they get to that point.
Tommy, I'm wondering, there may be men who are listening to this broadcast and maybe thinking, it may be bringing up some very difficult memories for them. How do we support men who have been the victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, particularly when they were young? What do you recommend?
It's a difficult question because these symptoms and the way they tell their narratives manifest in a lot of different ways. I think the first thing is we have to understand that men are sexually vulnerable. This is a big part of the work that I've been doing, especially with Black men, given, the kind of racist caricatures of them as being perpetrators and not victims. But the idea of sexual vulnerability, that being male means that you can, in fact, be sexually coerced, be made to penetrate, and have unwanted sexual contact at a very early age. The next thing is that I think that you have to listen to their stories and to their particular experiences. As a society, I think we're very hostile to the idea that men can be sexual victims. And I think as we work through different socioeconomic and racial groups, we become even more hostile to the point of deniability, where we want to fit them into certain boxes. So we need movements, we need educators, we need clinicians that are able to better help the society see that the experiences, the early sexual debut that these men have, are really important, and they're formative, right? They impact their psychology. They impact them throughout their life course. And lastly, is I think that we need movements like Me Too and other movements that are interested in sexual victims to come forward and actually start admitting the kind of prevalence we see, be it 12-month or lifetime prevalence in terms of male victims. Lots of racialized men, Black men in the United States report some of the highest rates of prevalence for sexual victimization and made to penetrate violence in the country, but they're never centered as victims of sexual violence. So that narrative, that data, the way that we educate the society needs to fundamentally change.
Tommy Curry is a professor at the University of Edinburgh. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post. And Dr. Richard Gartner is a psychologist and the co-founder of Male Survivor. Thank you all.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you can call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-4673.